It is Saturday, November 4th, 2006, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, our Weekend Geek News segment, followed by your calls with questions and comments of technology.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. During the second half of the show, I'll welcome you to join our conversation. You can ask us anything you'd like. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can contact us right now to get in the queue if you'd like by going to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. Geek Speak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry using digital technology for less radiation and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me, I have Geek Sean Cleveland, Technical Marketing Manager at NVIDIA. Sean, welcome to Geek Speak.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning.
We also have on the phone from Orange County, Alex Leas, Application Security Analyst for Fidelity National Financial. Alex, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you. Good morning.
We are going to be taking people's calls with questions and comments of technology during the second half of the program, but the first half of the program, we'd like to focus on the Week in Geek. As Alex mentioned earlier to me, it's a little light in news, but because of the midterm elections, I think we have some to talk about electronic voting, which is, of course, all over the place in all the tech shows right now. But why don't we go ahead and start with whatever's either of you would like to cover. Sean, I know you've got a couple news segments. Are you ready to take one off right now, or should we go ahead and start talking about voting systems?
Actually, Google launched their new mobile Gmail.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool feature.
It is pretty
cool. So have you tried it on your phone yet?
You know, I wanted to do it before the show, but I just have not had time. I've been so busy with work.
Alex, have you tried it?
No, I haven't.
Do you have a portable? Do you use your phone much for anything besides phones?
Like, not really. No? Yeah. I never quite got into the whole do everything with your phone concept.
So I have a Treo 650, which is a Palm-based device, and
it's had mail for a long time.
So I have, and I use what's called VersaMail on it for my own personal email. But to check my Google Gmail, I would have to open up a browser and then go there. It was just, and on a little mobile phone, very frustrating.
Yeah.
So this new application is Java-based, and according to their representative, with this new version, instead of taking 11 clicks to delete or archive a message, you can do it with 2. It's also much, much faster. You don't have to open a browser. So I'm very curious to see how it works.
I'm a little bit of a fan of this concept of getting things done. It's a way of managing your life. I cannot remember the author of the book, but I read and listen to 43folders.com, which kind of talks quite a bit about it. And one of the things they talk about is the way email's changing and how Google's interface is a very good way of dealing with it, in that it's very easy to archive an image, an email. And the idea, one of the concepts of getting things done is to get your email inbox to zero, to always have it at zero.
Right.
That it's not a place that you keep track of tasks.
They don't want you to delete mail.
Right. And so Google just says archive it, you know, so you can research it again.
Yeah, we're giving you plenty of space.
Yeah.
You can get emails up to 10 megs in size, which is a big reason why I have a Gmail account.
You know, I think it might even be larger than that.
It might be now, yeah.
But one of the things that I did with my email and changing the way I deal with emails, I used to do a lot of folder structures and save everything in different folders and filter that. And you, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago said, no, I just put everything in a year basis.
The problem was I used Outlook, and Outlook wouldn't search across folders. It drove me mad. So I just started leaving all my email in one folder.
But not your inbox.
And I used my search feature.
You take it out of your inbox and put it into... Like the year, right?
An archive for the year. Yeah, into the year. Yeah, I do that. So
that's
a
really good way to go.
The last 5 years of emails.
Just, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got all my emails since the beginning of emailing as well.
So on your mobile device, if you'd like to install this new Gmail app, you just open up your browser. Probably the last time you'll need to do this for Gmail. And go to gmail.com/app, A-P-P.
And that's for your phones. All right. Alex, I'm going to go ahead and go to you, sir.
All right. Well, I've looked up on some things. We got a FTC is preparing to kind of meet and discuss, I guess, some of their policies or ideas about dealing with technology. They do this, but they do this periodically, about once every 10 years. And last time they did it was a decade ago. So,
what'd they do then?
Basically, they kind of meet and try and foresee what the risks and concerns are going to be to the consumers regarding technology, and they offer a lot of guidance to various different regulators. So a lot of the protections we have in place are a result of the FTC kind of meeting and discussing these sorts of things.
And are you saying FTC?
FTC, Federal Trade Commission.
Now, do you think that FTC, the group that gets together for expertise on technology, is an intelligent group? Or is it one of these, like, mandated by a certain set of people and none of them have any experience?
They get together with some people that actually do have a fair understanding of technology. I don't really know the individuals themselves. But,
sure. What's their recommendations looking like right now?
Don't know. They actually will be meeting starting Monday.
Okay.
So it'll be interesting to see because the
FTC, been a while. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's been a while, and you know, a lot of what they say will greatly affect the privacy concerns regarding consumer information and stuff. So it's something I think everybody should be somewhat, at least, mildly aware of and follow.
Yeah. All right, let's talk a little bit about electronic voting. Midterm elections on Tuesday. The big thing I wanted to just mention is that, first off, most of our listenership does not won't have electronic voting machines in front of them, but over a third of the country will. And that's a pretty major amount of people that are dealing with electronic voting. And what I'm getting the consensus is at this point is, or the thing that I like the most, the idea of new electronic voting is, first off, I love the idea of electronic voting. I'd like to see a situation where we had a more rich democracy because we had more people involved in decision-making processes and had more responsibility. At the same time, I understand that most of the public doesn't really care that much. You can tell that by a lot of people not voting. But so I'm just going to urge that you vote. If you do run into an electronic voting machine and you don't feel comfortable with it, ask for a normal ballot. You can get one. It's pretty easy. And then the thing is, in talking with people over the years about electronic voting, what I've kind of come to the consumption or the idea is that it would be nice to have the paper trail, so the machine actually prints a paper trail, and that you don't actually get to keep the copy of the receipt. It kind of stays under glass. But there's some problems with that. And the new idea, which I like a lot, is you come in the door and you're handed your ballot. And then you can go and put it in a machine that will fill it out for you with a touchscreen interface, or you can fill it out yourself with pencil. And you can do either way because the ballot itself is exactly the same. And I love that idea because you remove this whole, obstruction. I mean, I like the idea of you go into your little booth, you have your machine there and your ballot, and if you decide to put it in the machine, fine. If you decide not to, fine. But it's a simple process, and you're still doing it with the same device. And that's very similar to how we do it in my voting area. We have these machines that kind of punch out the holes, the Chad thing. And you can, of course,
the hanging Chad.
Yeah, you can do that with a pencil. You don't have to put it in the machine to do it. It's just a hole that gets punched out. You can just do it. So it's kind of the same way.
We have what's called a pin.
A pin. Oh, yeah. You're a little...
And then it's a marker. You kind of mark in these holes.
A circle?
Yeah.
Well, would
it works
you like,
pretty well.
Would you like the idea of a touchscreen interface that you put your ballot in, and then you can fill it out, and it fills the holes in for you? Do you think that would be
appropriate way to go? If the other side of if half the screen told me a little bit about the candidate and reminded me what exactly I'm voting on, that would be kind of cool.
Yeah.
I would like more information at the time of vote.
But then,
if it's just like the paper and I'm just hitting the screen, I'm like,
what's different?
Yeah,
Alex, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I like the idea of having an actual ballot where it's still paper. The problem I have with a lot of the voting systems and the ones that are used in my area is that they show you a little piece of paper with the results on it, and sure, that leaves a paper trail, but that is not what's used for actually doing the tallying. So right. The paper trail is buried in. It's like having log files with, you know, millions of log entries, but you're not going to bother checking that unless there's a problem.
Right.
So there could actually still be tampering with the vote because it's all electronic.
Know. Sure.
And you don't really know. You know, nobody's going to think to go, oh, let's go check the paper trail. And, you know, sure, you have a paper trail, but what good is it if it's not really used for doing the tallying?
Sure. You know, the other thing I heard about these paper, the receipt thing, is one of the ideas is that you wouldn't give the actual paper to the person. You'd keep it in a roll. But the problem with that idea is, you know, it'd be under glass and you just, the person would be able to see it. The problem is that would queue up people, and if you're in the room and you're counting the million people that are in front of you, you could theoretically find out what the person's vote is. So there's a little bit of, you know, anonymity is lost in that system. So in any case, I just want to say, if you run into an electronic voting system, you don't have to trust it. Go ahead and get a normal paper ballot. And I wish that we were doing this better, because I think we could have a I like technology, and some of the sci-fi I read that talks about a world in which people can vote very quickly. It represents the populace more. In any case, let's go on to the next news story. I think I'm going to you, Sean.
Maybe not big news, but I found it interesting. In light of the recalls from Sony,
The laptops or the batteries?
The laptop batteries, uh-huh. Yeah. As everyone knows, or maybe you don't, but Dell and Apple mostly did a big recall on batteries because they were catching on fire. They were exploding.
Yeah,
get too hot.
It's never a good thing with a battery.
So there was a huge recall, and Sony is now replacing these batteries with new ones. And now they've announced a new Vio Type G notebook that will be the world's lightest notebook.
Is this associated with the batteries? Or?
Well, here's the thing. So Sony introduces this cool new notebook in Japan first. It'll come over here eventually. Weighs 898 grams. You know, 12-inch liquid crystal display screen. But, you know, nobody really is excited about that. The press is wondering, yeah, but can you supply the batteries for this? So Sony's got a lot to
recover.
They have a lot to recover from. It's Mindshare.
Yeah.
You know, all these companies who had the big recall, are they going to go to Sony next for the next generation batteries? You know, it's interesting. Sony's really having a hard time, I think, right now.
The one thing I think is interesting about these batteries, I haven't heard a story, maybe it was suppressed or something, but I haven't heard a story of someone really getting hurt.
No,
I have
not
either. It
seems
to be very
either.
Easy. Yeah. You know, you've got your laptop in your car and you're driving along. It's in the back seat in your car and it just bursts into flames. It's going to be a serious problem. I mean, it's a scary situation. So I'm surprised we haven't seen people hurt. I'm assuming that that's just because it's so infrequent that it happens.
I think somebody they ran the numbers, and statistically, you have a better chance of dying in an airplane crash than uh-huh. your notebook battery catching on
See,
fire.
I had heard, maybe it was from the geeks here on the show even, that the actual danger was a very, very specific process that you had to do. You had to, like, have your battery drained all the way, and then you had to put your... You know, you had to start to charge it and then put your machine to sleep. And you had to, like, do a set of things. And in that circumstance, it was repeatable. I don't think I heard that, actually, on this show. I heard it on a different podcast I listened to.
Yeah, interesting.
In any case. All right.
Wait, you listen to other podcasts?
I do.
What do you listen to?
You know, I listen to TWiT, which is This Week in Tech.
That's with John Dvorak.
John Dvorak's on it, yeah. There's a few people on it. It's okay. You know, it's similar to our show, except for they're all making money, and we all do it for volunteer work.
Their full time job is news and tech. So
they
definitely have a leg up in that.
But you know,
regard.
Sean, you should listen to it. It's Geek Speak's pretty good compared to it. I mean, it's we hold our own. We hold our own.
No one's listening.
Not when Miles isn't here. You know, of course.
No one's listening to us.
you know, at least we have a chance. Isn't This Week in Tech Leo Laporte?
Yeah, Leo Laporte runs it.
Yeah,
and he invites people in, and you know, it's all these people from Tech TV. So if you like the Tech TV show, the network that was canceled, the G4 network.
They must get some pretty high-powered guests on that show.
They don't really focus on guests. They focus on geeks that come in and talk. So sometimes it's really good. And Leo Laporte's doing this whole, like, network thing. He's also trying to rebrand podcast and change it into Netcast, because, of course, Pod is a trademark by Apple. So for that format.
Oh, interesting.
So he does a pretty good job.
We should
he has other open
Geekcast.
Yeah, right. Let's work on that. A lot of extra money.
All that
our
money
lawyers,
we have. Yeah.
All our powerful.
All
lawyers.
That money we're bringing in on our show.
I gotta say though, the T-shirt that you made for me with the GeekSpeak logo on
is it holding up?
It's holding up great.
We just gotta figure out how to buy more of those.
We just need to buy a whole bunch more. Maybe we should ask people to donate, you know, $10 to get a shirt, or like, you know, pre-buy, and then we'll get a big pool of money and go buy them and ship them out. Anyway, it sounds like a lot of work for
sounds
a volunteer.
Sounds like something you might want to volunteer for, Lyle.
Do I want to volunteer for that? I volunteer for a lot of stuff. Okay, let's go on to the next news story. You listen to Geek Speak. The guests are the geeks today. I'm Lyle Troxell. We have Alex Slias. He's on the phone from Orange County. And we have Sean Cleveland in the room with me. We're just going to do another 10 minutes of tech news of the week. Week in Geek. And then we'll be taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. You want to talk about... Alex, do you want to talk about the internet blunders thing?
The internet blunder, yeah. Basically, politicians beware. You know, we have John Kerry with his comment recently where he kind of blundered, or, you know, as the quote's going, botched joke. You know, the interesting thing is that the internet has kind of changed the rules of the game a little bit, and that when someone screws up like that, it just carries on and carry, you know, the impact is a little bit greater because of the internet. People discuss it, get the video, the audio just looping all over sites like, you know, Google Video and YouTube. So, you know, the politicians need to be a little bit more careful about, you know, what they're doing, because the effect is a little bit different. And it's kind of changed the rules for them a bit.
You know, it's frustrating, of course, because, you know, Kerry's just representing the Democratic Party. I'm not even sure if he's running again, but he's represented the Democratic Party, and making a, you know, a mistake in his speech causes people to not vote Democratic, not because of issues at hand, not because of anything that actually has to do with substantive work that they do, which is think about policy and help make our world a better place. It's more about a popularity contest, about how eloquently you can speak. And it seems, it's so ridiculous that we live in a society where our politicians, and I'm sure that's always been the case, but it's even more so, our politicians are celebrities, and we judge them on their hair and their clothes and who they, you know, date, rather than what they stand for and what they want to do in Congress. You know, what was one of the things that just hit me about this that frustrates the heck out of me? I'll think about it for a second. But Alex, do you have something to say more about that?
I could say that I absolutely agree. You know, it just seems like things get blown out a little bit too much out of proportion, and the internet it contributes to that, to kind of just carrying that on.
Yeah.
And it's just a little blunder, little thing that comes out, and oops, now it's all over the front page just because they spoke, you know, incorrectly.
Yeah, it makes more drama is what it does. It produces more drama, which removes, of course, from the factual information at hand and the policymaking process. Here's another example. The advertising, we don't get hit as much in California on it, and I don't actually watch television, so I don't know. But there's a lot of ads going on television right now, and there are a lot of attack ads. And I heard this great discussion about why that is, and it's always talked about, of course. But one of the things is that it's not about the issues, and it's not even about the people changing their mind. It's about getting people that think the same way as the ad implies to go out and vote. So it's about making people then go out and vote. And since it's not about changing the policy, it's just the status quo and upsetting you enough to be interested in voting, then there's no value to them from a perspective of making change in our world. So it's frustrating. In any case, let's get off the political bandwagon thing. Next news story, Mr. Cleveland.
Yeah, Seagate announced a cool new technology this week. They are actually putting full disk encryption technology into their hard drive.
Oh, that's cool. So you can actually pass it a parameter, and then it's going to hard drive encrypt and decrypt?
Yeah, every information that's written and read from the hard drive is encrypted, unencrypted on the fly using the drive technology. Your memory and CPU is not impacted at all.
How does the operating system tell it to what the code is?
The operating system has nothing to do with it.
Okay, but somebody has to say,
so when you first boot the system,
that
first access to the hard drive, you'll need to put in a password
to
boot off
it. So the operating system will have to do that? Or is it before the operating system?
It's before the operating system.
So there'll be like a BIOS prompt?
There'll be some sort of I would expect the Windows or in a PC, after the post screen where the BIOS information comes up, you'll probably need to put in a password.
How can the hard drive request that? I mean, you know BIOS is pretty well. How would a piece of hardware request
screen
access.
Well, the BIOS actually sets up the communication with all of the hardware in your computer.
So
once that communication is established, before any data is read from that drive, you'll probably need to put in a password.
So this would be only certain BIOSes would support this feature.
No, the whole idea is that if you lose your laptop, you don't need to worry about your data.
As long as the laptop's off.
It'll be encrypted. Yeah. It'll be encrypted with 128-bit encryption, AES. And supposedly, Seagate is saying that their technology doesn't impact performance or minimally. Yeah,
I can imagine it would minimally do it because hardware encryption, decryption can be pretty quick. But, Sean, the curiosity I have is if you were to implement this for, like, NVIDIA's chipset, wouldn't the BIOS have to know that there's going to be some kind of prompt of a user entry? I mean, could the hard drive just specify this, that it's necessary? Is there an interface there? Or would it have to be a BIOS update to actually allow this to happen? I don't know. I'd love to see it because I think it would be a great feature.
So they're calling it drive trust technology. Mm-hmm. Not to be outdone, Hitachi has announced similar plans to do the same thing with their hard drives. Taking it one step further, they announced hybrid hard drives. They come with a large region of flash memory.
We talked about this, I think, 2 weeks ago. Yeah.
Information from the hard drive is stored on flash. Let's say you're in Windows and you're running Word, you're surfing a web page. There's no reason why the hard drive needs to be running. All of that data could be stored into flash on the hard drive, and then the drive would just power down and save power. This is probably more for notebook-type applications where power is very important. And then Intel is also working on a hybrid technology called Robson. Robson's large amount of data and applications are stored in flash memory on the motherboard.
What company?
Intel.
Okay.
Intel's Robson technology.
Okay.
And the whole idea is that I don't know how realistic this is, but I think in a perfect world, your whole OS would be on this flash. So you would never even have to boot off the hard drive. It would just be on your motherboard.
Yeah.
So, you know, if flash is getting large enough to do that sort of thing, it could really cut down boot time. But, you know, I installed Windows XP on a full flash drive before.
Yeah, a long time ago.
When I had the access to a $30,000 hard drive. And, you know, it didn't make much difference to boot time.
Yeah.
Most Windows XP, the slowness is because it's going off and finding all the applications, is it preloading everything.
And all the drivers and all the equipment, scanning the
reading
hardware.
Through the registry, sure. Loading all your fonts. The more fonts you have, the slower your system's going
to
be.
So the trick would be for this is to the OS to actually do a kind of pre-caching of all that information.
Well, yeah.
Do you think
the OS
Vista's
needs to be written? Yeah, with Windows Vista, your boot time is going to be really,
and
really
we're gonna,
quick.
We're going to find out all about that next week.
Yeah, we're going to talk to a Microsoft representative next week about Vista. So, you know, we'll probably throw the if you have any questions, please go to geekspeak.org and send them to us. And
about Windows Vista.
We'll queue them up for our Vista rep next week. And at the end of the show, I think we'll ask again.
All right.
But, Windows Vista is supposed to boot much, much faster.
Okay, and I think, Alex, we will go ahead and ask you about quantum computing issues.
Yeah, quantum computing. Now, I'm not, you know, I don't follow the quantum computing world that closely, but it's kind of interesting that the scientists that are working to kind of develop quantum computing are looking at security concerns that, you know, hacking into the quantum computing network, you know, you flip the wrong bit and it causes problems where what they're looking at is you actually have to shut down the entire network, kind of a reset. I'm guessing because of how quantum computing kind of works on it or maintains a certain state. And so you mess up the state and the whole thing's screwed up and you got to reset the whole thing.
I think it's interesting about quantum computing is I've heard, you know, experts on the subject talk, and it just sounds like magic to me. And it's one of these situations where the lexicon's not set up well enough to be able to communicate effectively to the outside world. I mean, these mathematicians are dealing really amazing math. They're talking about it and trying to abstract it into computer terms. And then when we hear it, we're just like,
yeah,
it doesn't.
It's like flipping electrons.
Yeah.
You heard of that term?
Sure.
The future of storage is a type of RAM that uses electrons.
Isn't that a quantum problem, though?
Yeah. Because electrons could be flipped one way. They could represent a one and the other
That's
way.
That's the quantum state of the electron,
not really
right?
flipping them.
It's
they get changed.
Direction of spin or something like
yeah,
that.
It's about nobody really, you can't really describe what that means.
It's hard because we have this kind of visual conception that an electron is this little spherical object and it's spinning, but I mean, in reality, it's really not that. That's just our visual understanding of it.
Even the term spin is just an, they talk about color, they talk about flavor. There's all these things you talk about a particle, but in reality, that's not those things. They're just words that you use to make metaphor.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
spin even is not necessarily.
Describe
it's not
the reaction.
Spin. Right.
You really can't describe the reaction because
that's great.
It's so small.
Yeah, and so when they're doing the, you know, trying to create these protections in this quantum computing world, they're looking at getting into ways of trying to guard against these sorts of, attacks. And it's things like they're using old spy techniques, you know, having random intervals of communication, or what seems like random intervals of communication, and but pre-planned, and kind of all these little basic old-school security tactics that they're using to kind of mask and protect the communication or the communication across the quantum networks or quantum computing.
Right. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, Notary Public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com.
Listen each Tuesday and Thursday at 7:33 a.m. and 5:33 p.m. for Life in the Fast Lane with Kelly O'Brien. She'll keep you up to date with the latest from the world of alternative fuels, fuel efficiency, and how to avoid the dead end of oil dependency. Plus, if you have a question or comment for Kelly, you can phone her on the KSP comment line at 888-549-6421. That's Life in the Fast Lane, Tuesdays and Thursdays at 7:33 a.m. and 5:33 p.m. right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
You're listening to GeekSpeak. We're now taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free in California at 1-800-655-5877. Again, I'll give those numbers in just a second if you want to grab your pencils, but I just want to say that on GeekSpeak today is Sean Cleveland, who just spoke. Myself, I'm Lyle Troxell, and Alex Lias. We can take any questions or comments of technology you would like to ask us. The phone numbers are open. There's no one waiting. Rick is waiting to take your call. But other than that, there's nobody on the phone line. So you can get in there right now and ask us a question about anything you'd like. Here are the phone numbers one more time. 476-2800. That's 476-2800. Or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can use the internet. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. And we'll get that via email. GeekSpeak is supported by CruiseIO Internet, offering DSL broadband, computer rentals, and tune-ups. CruiseIO has retail stores in downtown Santa Cruz and Watsonville. More information can be found at cruiseio.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KSP. You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have Sean Cleveland, and over the phone, Alex Lias, and we'll take your calls with questions and comments of technology. One more time, 476-2800 or 1-800-655-5877. All right, the one other thing I wanted to mention is wikis. Wikis are just plain cool. The general concept is it's a website with multiple pages. Any people that participate in it can create new pages and edit any pages. Very cool features. And recently, Google just bought a small wiki startup company. And so I'm assuming that they'll be offering more wiki services for people in the near future. We're going to go ahead and take a call from Watsonville. Fred, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hello. What's your question?
I had something strange happen with my Mac. It's a MacBook Pro that I had kept updated to 10.4.8, and I...
What's the strange thing that happened?
What?
What is the strange thing that happened?
The strange thing that happened, I was really filling up the hard drive, so I cleaned it out to where I had at least 12 gigabytes available, which still wasn't quite enough, but I felt like I could stop there. And within a couple of days, there was only 2 gigs left, and I couldn't understand because I had not downloaded any large files or anything. So I went searching and found a 10 gigabyte log file in the library.
A log file?
A log file that was 10 gigabytes in a matter of 2 or 3 days.
All right. Who is making that log file? Is it Firefox?
I didn't actually even investigate. I was like at the point where the computer wouldn't run anymore because the drive was too full.
Sure.
And so I deleted that log file, emptied the trash, and everything has been fine since.
Have you looked for that log file again to see if it's being recreated?
Well, I haven't actually looked for there weren't any named files. It was just log one and then log 1.1 or something like that.
Right. So you're basically going to, you could go back in that folder, look at the logs, and see if anything's growing large again.
Right. Well, it hasn't happened so far.
I would keep track of it to some degree. Very interesting. Okay, so that's an unusual thing.
Why don't you blame Google right away, Lyle?
Why did I blame Firefox? Right?
Excuse me, Firefox, yes. Why did I blame Firefox 2.0?
Because Alex and I earlier today were chatting about how Firefox's virtual memory is very big, meaning that when you run Firefox and you let it run for a long time, it seems to grow. And Alex had actually told me about it. Alex, what was the size of yours on a Windows machine?
Oh, yeah. When I was at work, I let mine run overnight, and I've got a few windows that are kind of refreshing, auto-refreshing the page. And it was up to, I think, just about 700 megabytes of real memory. Real memory, not even the virtual memory. And then my system started complaining about being out of virtual memory, too. So it was.
And that issue kind of prompted me to look at it, because I've been running Firefox 2 probably for 3 days without restarting it. And so I looked, and my virtual memory is at a gigabyte. Which I think is a little large for caching, basically.
And that was just for Firefox.
That was just for Firefox's virtual, yeah. And so that's why when I started reading this story from you, Fred, that I kind of thought maybe it's a Firefox 2 issue, but I didn't check where that quote virtual memory is being used. It's probably the OS is handling it, so it probably wouldn't be in logs. But so you were able to solve the problem, Fred?
Well, actually, I'm looking at it, and I again have a 10 gigabyte library file.
Yeah. Okay. So, if you, 10 gigabyte or 10 megabyte?
Gigabyte.
What's the path that you're seeing this in?
This is in the from root to library.
And then inside library, is it something else?
And then inside library, I'm waiting for it to calculate all the folder sizes. I don't see yet which one it's in.
Okay.
So it's working on it. But I also had another question.
Go ahead.
I just upgraded to the latest Firefox, and on the upgrade got this whole window full of all these extensions to install. And I said, sure, I'll try them. And I installed like five or six at once. And I have no idea really what any of them are. The thing that's most annoying is I think the Delicious one, which takes over the bookmark file, so I no longer have access to my my toolbar.
Delicious
bookmark toolbar.
A Delicious, for those that don't use it, is a free public bookmarking system. So you save your bookmarks on a website, and then you can share them with friends and the rest of the world. But they don't have hierarchy, and a lot of people take bookmarks and actually produce a hierarchy structure. Instead, they use a thing that's called tagging. So, have you been able to uninstall that extension and your bookmark file show up again?
No. I actually just did get the toolbar back because I see there's a little Delicious icon at the left-hand side of the toolbar.
Well, let me just do this for you. Before you investigate any further, go ahead and go find your bookmarks file, and this is where it is.
Okay.
Inside your Macintosh, in your current user, inside a folder called Library, there's another folder called Application Support, I think it is. Inside there's going to be a Firefox or Mozilla folder. And inside there'll be one or two profiles.
Right.
Then there'll finally be, in one of those folders, there'll be a bookmarks.html. Just copy that. Make a copy of it to your desktop. And then you can open that with a browser and see all your bookmarks as links and as in which page. So I suggest that. Well, that's a very good point. I would recommend, especially when you're installing a browser for the first time, don't install everything you want. Everything possible.
Yeah.
Kind of run it for a while and add things as you need them. Well, thank you, Fred, so much for the call.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
From line two is from Scotts Valley. Will, welcome to Geek Speak. What's your question today?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a general question. I use Yahoo as my internet provider.
Okay.
And they have a system where when you get spam, it's put into your bulk folder. And I'm wondering how do they do that? How do they intercept these? And it's very effective. I get virtually no spam on my other in my regular mailbox.
Right, it all goes to bulk.
And only once in a while is one or two messages in the bulk folder that I want to read.
Yeah. Well, there's lots of ways to, there's a whole algorithm basically to do this, but The systems normally analyze the message, take a look at it, and try to find things that make it look unlike messages that normal people make. And that has to do with mail server settings and what IP addresses they come from and whether they're on that IP address is known to be a spamming location. That's kind of the first level of defense. Later, then you start analyzing the actual content of the message. And if it's talking about free drugs on the internet, that term has a higher probability of being spam. And so there's a ranking system. Now, Yahoo has this great ability to look and analyze everybody's mail and kind of assume what is good and what's bad. So when you take a message you find in bulk and remove it from bulk, it tries to improve its systems to figure out why that got marked as bulk and tries to get smarter. But at the same time, you've got these people that are making a lot of money, spammers are making a lot of money, trying to figure out a way to not go in that bulk mail. So it's a battle of intelligent programmers, basically. And it's not a simple process by any means. It's getting more and more complicated.
Yeah, in other words, if there's some address that you're reading regularly, that would be protected from going in there.
Well, the way Yahoo probably does it right off the bat is if you have an address book, or if you have any messages you send to, like say you get an email address and then you reply to them, that's assuming you have a relationship with them, they're more likely to be kept out of your bulk mail folder. That's almost always a setting. Now, there's probably a setting in Yahoo, some kind of options thing. I don't use it primarily as my email client. But there's probably under preferences, under settings, you can look at what's some of the rules and you can kind of change them. Be conscious of that. If it's working pretty well, I wouldn't worry about it. If you do get messages that go into your bulk folder, this is pretty much any system, make sure to add that person's name to your address book, or that email address to your address book, because that will probably help. And I'm talking about address book in the mail client that you're dealing with.
I've never had a person. It's been an organization. One
organizations normally look more like that.
Yeah. It's extremely effective.
Yeah, good.
I'm amazed at it.
I wish I could say the same about all spam, that it disappears in the bulk folder. That's a good thing to note. If you're using a web service, you probably do get your mails put into bulk folder. Do check it every once in a while. The default settings normally are to delete it after a certain period of time, and it could be that you get a message in there that you really want, so definitely take a look. Well, thank you so much, Will, for the call.
Yeah, I look them over. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, Lyle, what's a good way to prevent that happening?
Prevent the bulk mail going in, or the message going to a bulk?
Yeah, or spam folder.
You definitely have to have your friends list, your white list, your address book, the thing that says, all these people I trust enough that if they send me a message, don't even look at
it. Right, right. So usually
that's important.
In Thunderbird, I know, which is made by Mozilla, you can actually say, don't send anybody whose email address is in my contact list to a junk folder.
And that's a
or
default
spam.
Setting for most of them.
So you just need to make sure you've got all of those people in your contacts. So maybe new people who you get email from, right-click on their email address and add to the contact.
That's right. And in fact, if you right-click on the email address, it'll prompt up a window and it'll say either open in contacts or add to contacts. That's at least in mail. I'm assuming Firefox, Thunderbird does the same thing. So you can see pretty quick if it's in there and you'll get a feel for it. I did a thing in mail which basically says it's a thing you can actually mark messages with. It's normally called filtering. You can do it probably in Thunderbird as well, where when the message comes in, it takes a look at it, and depending on what I set up, it changes the color. So I say, if the person is not in my address book, change the color to yellow. So over time, I'm slowly adding everybody, because anybody that comes in that's not in my address book, it flags it for me, and I go, add that person or not.
Is that pretty easy to do?
In mail, it is. I didn't try it in Thunderbird. I would take a look at it, see if there's something you can do like that.
It's a good idea.
It's a great way to go, I think. You could even, in Thunderbird, you could probably copy it to a folder, because I know that it does provide copying features and that kind of thing. Okay, from Pacific Grove, Gene, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you.
Yeah, certainly.
Good morning.
Good morning. What's up?
I have a general question also. Only mine is turns out the software package for doing my taxes that I've used for the past few years, TurboTax, it said, "Well, too bad we don't support your computer." And I think they said Microsoft does not support Windows 98 or ME anymore. Right. I have ME. And therefore, I can't do my taxes using TurboTax.
You know, TurboTax is one of those things that tax software in general is an annual. You've got to buy a new copy.
Right.
And I see why they're doing this. It makes a lot of sense. I'm assuming that Microsoft's not paying them to do this, but it sure does help Microsoft.
I thought Microsoft bought TurboTax, maybe.
Oh, well, that sure would do it, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
The thing is, it's totally true. The geeks recommend not using Windows 98 and Windows ME anymore. The problem with it, of course, is that the current machine that you bought that runs Windows 98 or ME probably can't handle Windows XP. Or if it can, it's going to be slow and difficult. and it's going to be an expense. So there's this whole issue of whether, you know, whether you want to upgrade. But in this situation, yeah, the reason they don't want to do that is that Microsoft, I'm sorry, 98 is not supported by, or IMEI. IMEI is basically just a little skin on top of 98. It's a little modifications. But yeah. The operating system is no longer supported by Microsoft, which means that there's no safety net for that company that writes software on it. If they release new software, a new version of the software, and sell it to you for a profit, and then put it on a platform that isn't actually supported, and later somebody breaks into your system and steals your bank account information, right? They are now kind of in the dark about whether they did something right or not, because they know that this operating system is no longer safe.
Okay, I can give them that.
What it is.
Then let's go another way.
Sure.
TurboTax says you can run TurboTax online using Microsoft Internet Explorer 6.0. In other words, I could do my taxes online.
Sure, they'll save that information for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a big one, isn't it? I wouldn't do it.
Okay.
I mean, the thing is, it's interesting. If I knew the policy of the company and I knew that they were going to erase my information, there was very clear procedures, and there was a contract in which they were liable if they even saved my information for more than 2 days,
yeah,
something like that, then I'd do it. But considering the way information is, normally companies have backup procedures, and later on that company will be bought by somebody else. Basically, if you put your tax information into some company, that company, that asset of that information will be owned from there on out by some company. I mean, there's no way you get around it.
Yep.
So don't let a company have it unless they have a very strict policy of deleting it.
Yep.
But they're not going to, because they have a backup service.
Even then, the policies can change.
That's right.
Yeah. I called H&R Block.
Yeah.
And they were very forthcoming, and they hadn't set their system standards yet for the year. So
okay.
they weren't able to tell me if they'd be able to do it. I hate to have to buy a new computer just to do my freaking taxes.
What are you doing taxes for in November? Come on.
I get this stuff done, man.
I wait till April. No,
what they're doing is they're saying, you know, they're pushing Vista.
Yeah.
Of course, Vista's not even out.
Right, right. Yeah. Buy a computer now because Vista's, yeah, oh, man.
Oh, okay, another question about Vista then?
Go ahead.
They're selling computers now, and I thought Vista wasn't going to be backward compatible with anybody. But they're selling computers saying this will be forward compatible
yes,
with this.
Yes, that's okay.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
The spec has been released by Microsoft of what will be compatible, what will be good. And so people can now put the labels
we're
on.
We're going to talk about
on.
That next week.
Yeah.
We'll talk
there,
a lot
there
about
There are
that.
Different levels of that. Just so that's you understand, right. If you really want access to the new 3D features, you got to have access to Vista Premium.
So the icon of that will go with a piece of hardware that you're buying will say what kind of level it will run. Pretty much everybody can run, any new machine can run Vista at some level, but it will be no better in its interface design than the current operating system.
You know, there's a lot of good reasons to upgrade to Vista. Gene, I've been doing a lot of digging, and it's going to be interesting next week.
Well, if I go out and buy a computer now, it would be XP and the latest home edition.
Right, but you would get... I think now
you'll
already,
get a free you'll
get a free upgrade path.
Depending on who you buy your computer from, there may be a free upgrade path, but it'll be a lot more inexpensive than buying a full version.
Gene, the other thing to do is that TurboTax is not the only company that does tax software.
Right,
you can go ahead and get somebody else's.
I'm looking
and,
around.
And if you're really concerned about the whole 98 thing, Miles, who's normally here every week, says very strongly, "Don't use 98 anymore. Get a new operating system." But the problem is, it's expensive, and the hardware you're not going to get a lot of improvement right off the bat unless you buy new hardware. So, the one thing you could do is, I mean, maybe we should do a whole show on Ubuntu solutions and just like, what's the tax solution for Ubuntu, which is a free operating system which you could run concurrently with your current system. Well, Gene, good luck. Let us know if you buy a new machine. I'd love to know if that was the solution you had to go with.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
You know, it's funny, Miles and Drew are just so onto this Ubuntu kick.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got our gaming systems set up at your house, and Miles said, oh, let's boot Ubuntu real quick. And he pulled out a CD, put it in the machine, booted Ubuntu, and we're in the OS, and we're actually using the system.
Quick.
And it's that easy.
You were impressed, huh?
I was impressed.
But they don't have TurboTax for it. Okay, so from Santa Cruz, Hal, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Good morning. Two questions. First, a lot of discussion today, both about browsers and email. Do you guys have a consensus on a client for email? I've heard
an email
kind of
client
good things about several.
I
mean, what about Thunderbird?
Are you on a Windows machine?
Yeah, and I hate Outlook.
Yeah, Sean,
and I do a lot
do?
Of email, and I got a huge amount of material, and I do make separate folders for them.
I would suggest Thunderbird because Sean uses it, and he's on a Windows machine, and I use it whenever I'm on a Windows machine.
I can't think of anything else I would use.
Okay.
You know, unless you're working for a company or you have a Microsoft Exchange server,
and you
have to use Outlook. Yeah,
no, Thunderbird definitely, and Thunderbird will import all your Outlook folders.
Terrific.
Outlook is great when an IT, you know, when you have an IT group running it and taking care of it, and doing the updates and all that stuff. It's great.
Yep.
But otherwise, personal email, Thunderbird just works great.
Now, Hal, I want to suggest one thing to you, and I'm going to suggest this to anybody who's thinking about switching out of Outlook. Pretty much any application, when you have really interesting and important information, make sure before you do the upgrade path to make a copy of that information. And it's pretty easy in Outlook. There's a file on your computer that's called something.pst. That's
I've got a lot of PSTs.
Make copies of it before you install
Thunderbird. Just do a search on your C drive, right-click on your C drive in Windows Explorer.
No, I know. And
do a search on that.
I have multiple copies of my PSTs, which I update frequently.
Good.
Okay, second question. I downloaded the latest Internet Explorer and Firefox, and now I'm getting pop-up windows like crazy, which I
really
didn't have.
Okay, so first off, inside both of those both of them, look at the preferences and make sure that pop-up blocking is enabled. That's important. The next thing is that it's possible that that while you're doing downloads and installs, you downloaded something and installed something that is actually malware. Probably not, but I would definitely make sure that both those things in the system preferences enable pop-up blocking. Have you already checked that?
I didn't check that.
Okay, definitely check that. I don't know if Internet Explorer has that by default. And Internet Explorer might have, when it installed, it probably made it the default browser. And Firefox might not now be the default browser, so that might be one of the reasons why you're seeing more pop-ups, because you're actually running Internet Explorer more.
I do some things where I need Internet Explorer to be the default browser. Things don't work if I try to, click on a link.
Sure.
And it goes to Firefox. I've had to set Internet Explorer as my default.
Okay, so
browser.
there's a great little trick here, and I cannot recall the name of it. About two shows ago, it's on our GeekSpeak website. So if you go to geekspeak.org, you click on last week's or the week before show, we have a little write-up on it, and it's basically an extension to Firefox that allows you to specify some URLs as using Internet Explorer inside Firefox. So basically, you run Firefox all the time, and then when you visit some sites, like your bank site that you require or whatever, it will. You set it up to say load this page inside Internet Explorer, and Firefox will actually load the application of Internet Explorer inside one of its windows and load that web page for you. So it'll still look and act like Firefox. You'll still be able to bookmark things with Firefox. You'll still be able to use all of Firefox's features. So that's one thing I suggest doing. Go ahead and go to geekspeak.org and click on a couple shows back. Hey, Hal, thank you so much for the call.
Hey, thanks, guys.
All right, we're going to go ahead and go to the next call from Rick in Pacific Grove. Rick, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you very much.
What's your question today, sir?
Well, I have just set up a home network, wireless, and I have a LaserJet 1200 printer I got a few years ago, and I wonder if that's possible to hook that into the system rather than other just directly through my desktop.
You mean plug it into your network?
Yeah, plug it into the network.
Yeah, there's these little printer block things that basically it's an IP printer solution. Does that printer have a parallel port or a USB port?
It has both.
Okay. Well, that means it's a relatively newer printer to some degree. I think you can get... Sean, have you ever played with these things, like the Ethernet to USB?
Yeah, they work great, except if you have a multifunction printer, you can't use the scanning capabilities.
No, it's a straight laser.
If it's a straight printer, then it should work.
So it's a little box called what are those called things? IP printer box?
Now, are we talking just to hook up to your network?
Yeah, just network.
So you plug the USB into a box, hook that up to your network. Yeah, you can find those from Netgear and LinkBoost. Any networking company, they sell these things. And yeah, it works great.
They work great. Yeah. The one thing is that your computer might not detect automatically when you try to share it on your network. The computers might not detect what version of the printer it is, right? So you're going to have to know that and make sure that when you set up your printer device to that network device, that you specify exactly the printer driver.
The documentation that comes with it's pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
So for me, it worked right away.
I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, and what's nice is, if you're sharing the printer through somebody's computer right now, you always have to have the computer on. With one of these little boxes hooked up to your network, you don't have to have any computer on. It's really kind of nice. And you can move that printer to anywhere in the house.
Okay.
Wireless is another way to go, too. Then you're not all you need is a power cable.
All right, we're going to take one more call. Thank you so much for calling.
Okay, it was called IP printer box?
IP printer boxes. You'll find it with that, yeah.
Okay.
I think so. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Or send us an email. Go to geekspeak.org. Click on Geeks, and I can help you find a couple.
This is going to be the last question answered today by in Santa Cruz. Woody, welcome to Geekspeak.
Hi there, guys. Thanks a lot. I'll try to be quick because I may run out of time. Basically, I've finally got around to burning my CDs into MP3s. I'm going MP3 just because I
bought a CD. The process of taking a CD to an MP3 file is called ripping.
Right.
Burning is actually making a CD.
Oh, I'm sorry. So you're right. So I am ripping. Uh-huh. Right. I am ripping. And I'm just wondering about the best rippers available. I have a Creative portable, and it came with software. There's iTunes would also work. I was online.
What do you mean? What do you mean in quality? Do you mean the quality of the music?
Yeah, the reproduction. You know, like what do any of the MP? Because I didn't realize this, but I did a little research, and it's like, you know, all MP3 files are not the same. I mean, obviously there's compression, so I'm trying to do it about 256 because I want this to be archivable. I'm talking about getting maybe rid of my CDs, which is
those blasphemy. Those files are going to be immensely big compared to most MP3s. A 256, I think 192 is pretty good. Now, if you're an audiophile and you have amazing audio quality systems, then the better, the higher the better. But I think there's a level of return here that is.
You're at 192. Is what you're saying?
You're overpassing. Well, no, I think there's people out there that can definitely hear the difference between. Like a WAV file and a 192 MP3, but it's only on some types of music, you know, only some types of situations they run to, and if they have an amazingly good sound system.
Uh-huh.
So I'm always sensitive to say you're overdoing it on audio because some people can hear it and will thrash me.
Right.
But,
I don't have the super high end right now, but like this was going to be my archive because I was talking about getting rid of my CDs, and so I'm doing it at a variable bit rate, which I heard. But I was just wondering between like the
next
major ones available out there, Creative, iTunes, and there's one called the unfortunate acronym called LAME.
LAME is actually probably the best encoder out there that I've heard of for MP3 encoding. In fact, people prefer it over like iTunes. But you can actually install LAME as the encoder for iTunes. So it's a difficult thing. Unfortunately, I don't have a good solution for you. I think a 192 file of MP3 sounds good, but I don't listen to a lot of music. So
you would say LAME is better than like the Creative or the iTunes?
I would say that I have heard that LAME is better than Creative or iTunes.
And I can actually, I can set that up inside of iTunes to be the burner.
You can. Or you
the
can.
Encoder.
Yeah, at least on a Mac you can. I'm assuming you can also on a Windows.
Yeah, I'm on a Windows, so I don't know, but I'll look into that.
Definitely. Thank you so much.
The only thing
for
is it was slower. I know it was slower than the other ones. Like Creative is pretty fast.
Yeah.
But
of course, the slower you go, the better quality you have. Thank you so much for the call.
All right, thanks,
bye-bye.
The previous call, the caller wants to look for a print server.
For
sharing a printer on your network,
yeah,
look for a print server.
Print server is what we're looking for. Okay, the Geeks today, Sean Cleveland and Alex Slias, thank you both very much for being on GeekSpeak today. Sean, you've got something more to read, right?
Yep. Listen to the unique voices of our community on First Person Singular, bringing you local arts and poets, novelists, students and teachers, community activists and retirees with their stories and anecdotes on a wide range of topics. That's First Person Singular every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 7:33 a.m. and 5:33 p.m. and on Sunday afternoon at 4:58 p.m., just before weekend, all things considered. Only on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
GeekSpeak is registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Microsoft's new operating system, Vista, is making its way into our reality. But what does it do? Why is it good for you? And is it worth it? This coming week on GeekSpeak, the Geeks are joined by Microsoft representative and we'll talk all about Microsoft Vista. That's GeekSpeak Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. right after Dr. Don, only on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Auto, on the web at kusp.org. I want to thank Sean Cleveland, Alex Slias, and Rick Philman for the work they do every week on GeekSpeak, and I also want to thank all of you for listening to GeekSpeak. Thank you so much for listening to GeekSpeak. We enjoy doing it. I hope you enjoy listening to it.